It's nice to be with all of you this morning. When Dwayne came up to me in October after the weekend meeting and asked me about a date for 2015, I was very excited at that prospect. I was thinking, what will we talk about this morning? Knowing that my time to be with you was coming, I've been thinking about this for quite a while. I knew what I wanted to talk about this afternoon, but what I wanted to talk about this morning, I didn't quite land on something till last night. And don't worry, I didn't throw it together last night, but that's when I finally decided. I'd like to talk about something that will not be immediately relevant to everyone here, but is immediately relevant to many of you here. That would not have been true 22 years ago when I first visited this congregation, but it's true now. I'd like to talk about parenting. Edgar Guest was a English-born poet, and in the early 20th century, he was putting out, I don't know how much poetry, but I suspect a fair amount. And he's got some memorable verses, and I'd like to read to you one of his poems entitled Treasures. It reads as follows. Some folks I know, when friends drop in to visit for a while and chin, just lead them around the rooms and halls and show them pictures on their walls and point to rugs and tapestries, the works of men across the seas. Their loving cups they show with pride to eyes that soon are stretching wide with wonder at the treasures rare that have been bought and gathered there. But when folks come to call on me, I have no such things for them to see. No picture on my walls is great. I have no ancient family plate. No tapestry of rare design or costly woven rug is mine. I have no loving cup to show or strange and valued curio. But if my treasures they would see, I bid them softly follow me. And then I lead them up the stairs through trains of cars and teddy bears, and to a little room we creep where both my youngsters lie asleep. Close locked in one another's arms, I let them gaze upon their charms. I let them see the legs of brown curled up beneath a sleeping gown and whisper in my happiness, behold the treasures I possess. 15.5 years ago at Cox South, a little girl entered my life. And I knew, although I had no concept of all the I would need to learn and all that, I knew that what she would become was largely dependent upon me. One brother in the church told me that when he looked down at his firstborn son the day he was born, he thought to himself, I have one shot at this. And those words are so true. God has so organized the universe. I don't know why He did it this way, but He did. He has so organized the universe that souls that are eternal, that will spend eternity either in heaven or hell, will partly be shaped by me and by you. Edgar Guest called his children his treasures. 4 times in the Old Testament, God calls his children his special treasure. He's telling us how we ought to view them. And I know we do. You know, Romans chapter 9, Paul talks about the very beginning of that chapter. He said that he had a great love for his countrymen, his kinsmen in the flesh. And he talks about how he's even entertained the idea of damning himself, if it were possible. He says, I've entertained the idea of sending myself to hell so that I could save them. And I think to myself, do I have that kind of love for the souls of the lost? But one thing I've realized that helps brethren connect with that is, if you could guarantee your child would go to heaven, if you knew right now you've got an adult child here, some of you do, and that child is not on the path to heaven, if you knew that you could guarantee that child would go to heaven by condemning yourself to hell, would you do it? There was a man in the church up in Excelsior Springs who was not raised in the church. He came to the church late in life, regrets how he raised his own children. And when he heard me bring that up, he said, in a heartbeat, in a minute. See, he loves his children that much, and I'm sure many of you in the room do as well. We love our children, we want what's best for our children, but we don't always give it. I want to talk this morning about some things we can do to raise up these children for service to God and for a future with them. And I guess I'd like to say very briefly here that I'm working on the assumption that this is what we want for our children. What's your one goal for your children, those of you who are raising them right now? Well, I've got lots of goals, John. What's your primary goal? Is there one overriding goal you have for your children? I remember watching a young father. We were both younger even now than I am at the time. He was holding his son. And this man is very good with his hands. He likes to work out in the garage. He likes to be out with the wind in his hair. And he was holding this little boy and he was telling him how he couldn't wait till the time that the two of them could get out in the garage and he could show him how all the machines he's got work and so forth. And that's fine. But I thought to myself at the time, but what about this other more important stuff? This man's mind was not focused on the most important things. The most important thing, of course, that we can give our children is the tools to ready themselves for eternity. How do we do that? Well, number one, I've got four things, and I'll try not to abuse your patience this morning. But number one is we must first look to ourselves. Acts chapter 20, verse 28, when Paul is with the Ephesian elders, he says to them, Therefore take heed to yourselves and to all the flock. Yes, you need to be paying attention to the congregation over which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers, but first, take heed to yourselves. The first and most important thing I must do if I wish to raise up godly offspring is to myself be godly. The most important thing I can do if I wish to raise up children who will choose to become Christians is to be a Christian. 2 Corinthians 13:5, Paul said, examine yourselves as to whether you are in the faith. Test yourselves. Do you not know yourselves that Jesus Christ is in you, unless indeed you are disqualified? Is my spiritual life in order? Do I stand right now as one accepted by God? Am I qualified to lead my children in the paths of righteousness? How many here have flown in the past 5 years? Can I get a show of hands? All right. You get on the plane, and the steward or the stewardess comes in, and they go through the whole process about, well, if we lose cabin pressure, these masks are going to fall down. And when the mask falls down, what do they tell you to do with it? Put it on yourself first. Now, why do they do that? Because they know that parents loving their children are going to go, oh, here, honey, let me get that on you. And then they run the risk of passing out, and then they're no good at all. They can't help their child. Help yourself first. This is the rule that we must apply in raising up our children. Unless the Lord builds the house, Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. Blessed is the man who fears the Lord, who delights greatly in His commandments. His descendants will be mighty on the earth. I can't very well teach my children to be something that I am not. A river does not rise above its source. I might be able to fake it for a while, but my children are with me day in and day out. They see me in the best of times and the worst of times, and they're going to see through me if I'm not the real thing. Only by being a true servant of the Lord can I be sure to have understanding in place that will allow me to rightly instruct them and also have an example in place that will be teaching them when my words aren't. The importance of example is almost beyond words. More is caught than taught. Parents can tell but never teach until they practice what they preach. And we parents should always remember that someday our children are going to follow our examples instead of our words. Abraham lied about Sarah. And Isaac learned it well. He went and lied about his wife in almost the exact same words. And then his son Jacob was a liar. Like father. Like grandfather. David sinned sexually with a woman who was not his wife. And what did his son Amnon do but go and do something not unrelated? Paul said, imitate me as I imitate Christ. 1 Corinthians 11:1. Most of us want examples to follow. We choose someone. Young men do this particularly. I have no experience being anything except a young man. But as a young man, you choose someone to follow, to mold yourself after. I don't know. Maybe there's some young men who've never done that, but I think in general, this is what we do. We find someone, we say, I want to be like him. And we shape ourselves, for better or for worse, like that individual. Children are the exact same way. They are very reliable mirrors. In parenting, we give what we get. They will learn our good behavior and our bad. And we have to live according to the things we say. Exhortation without example is hypocrisy. And nothing so effectively nullifies all credibility and overrides good teaching than hypocrisy. Someone once said, what you do speaks so loud, I cannot hear what you say. It can also teach the child to do the same thing. Well, hey, if dad goes and teaches all these things but doesn't really practice them all that well at home, I guess that's okay. That must be the way Christianity operates. Hypocrisy breeds bitterness and contempt in a child, potentially, because the child can see that you're not living up to what you insist on. We must begin with ourselves. Point number two, if you're taking notes, I believe what we first next must do as parents is we must win our children's hearts. What do you mean by that? I mean we must build a positive relationship with them. We do the will of God, Ephesians chapter 6, verse 6 says, from the heart. That's an important point. When I am obedient to God, I do that from the heart. True and lasting obedience is not the product of external pressures. I don't obey God ultimately and for the long term because of the prodding of peers or the pushing of my parents or the pulling of popularity or for anything else. I do it because I want to. Because I want to make Him happy. It's the result of an inward, voluntary decision on the part of me. And what's true on a physical level is true spiritually as well. Proverbs 23:26 is where I get the phrasing, win your child's heart. In Proverbs 23:26, Solomon says to his son, my son, give me your heart. Now, why does Solomon say that? And what does he mean? My son, give me your heart. I mean, Solomon's got all this wisdom. Isn't sharing that wisdom with your son enough? No, Solomon says, my son, give me your heart. That is, give me your confidence. Give me your allegiance. Give me your affection. Give me your trust. Because only in that environment will my teaching be successful. Successful instruction cannot fully take place without the heart of the student. Rules without relationship breed rebellion. You know, you look across throughout the church and you see the way people raise their children. And some are what we consider very strict. Some are not so strict. And sometimes the children don't turn out well in both camps. And people sometimes are inclined to chalk it up, well, they were just too strict. Or they weren't strict enough. The thing is, though, you can look at other families that were just as strict or more strict and the children turned out and they adopted the values of their parents and they've carried them through and are just as strict with their own children. And you can find other kids in the other camp who, though the parents were much more free and allowing, they turned out quite well and they adopted the values of their parents. So there's something more going on than strictness or not strictness. I think it's relationship. If I insist with my children, you do thus and so, but I have not built a relationship with them where they know that I truly, genuinely care about them, I want to spend time with them, I enjoy them, it's hard for them to have a desire to do what I tell them. We can all relate to that, I think. If I have my child's heart, they do what I say because they value the fellowship they have with me. And they don't want to compromise that. They don't want to disappoint me. They don't want to displease me. Well, I follow you, John, but how do you get a relationship like that? I didn't have one like that with my parents. I certainly don't have one like that with my children right now. I don't even know how to get that. Well, the Bible gives us the answer. Malachi chapter 4, verse 6, in a prophecy concerning John the Baptist. This is figurative language, but a concept is laid down. Malachi chapter 4, verse 6, the prophet says concerning the coming prophet, "He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the hearts of the children to the fathers." Now notice the order there. We turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and then the hearts of the children to the fathers. If I want my child's heart, what must I do first? I must give my child my heart. What do you mean by that? We love him. Why? Because he first loved us. 1 John chapter 4, verse 6. My children want this kind of relationship with me, but they don't know how to get it. The onus is on me as the parent. Love is magnetic. Jesus said, "And I, if I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all peoples to myself." Love inspires love, and it draws people. Right now, for those of us who are parenting, what's your answer to this question? What love are you showing your children right now which would draw them to you? Are you right now a magnet or are you a repellent? In parenting, we get what we give. How much time are you spending with your children? You know, I cannot expect to quote-unquote disciple my children if I don't spend time with them. It's interesting, in Mark 3:14, when we have Jesus, it speaks of the disciples being with him. Listen how Mark records this. Mark 3:14, it says, "Then he appointed the 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach." Look at Jesus' goal. He picked the 12 first so that they could simply be with him. This was an apprenticeship. Really one of the most, if not the most, effective way to train anyone in anything. I had a doctor at Children's Mercy Hospital in Kansas City tell me this. He said something like 80% maybe or more of what I do, I could train someone to do in a couple of years. Just through apprenticeship. I don't know anything about the medical world, but this was coming straight out of a respected doctor's mouth. This is an effective way of training, and it's what goes on in the church. Jesus picked these men so they could simply be with him. And in Acts 4:13, when two of those men were standing before an educated Sanhedrin with boldness, what does the Scripture say? "Now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and untrained men, they marveled and they realized that they had" what?
Been with Jesus.
These men had been shaped by the man whom they had spent time with. My children, I wish to shape them to serve the Lord. Assuming I am serving the Lord, I want them to spend time with me so that they can see what a servant of God looks like, and talks like, and thinks like. I need to spend time with them. I need to focus on them. I need to listen to them. I listened to a book several years ago called My Lobotomy. I know that sounds exciting. But it was about a man who'd had one of those lobotomies by Walter Freeman. I don't know, back in the 50s and 60s when they were doing all that. Basically putting an ice pick through your eye and going in there and literally scrambling your brain and hoping that would help you. Didn't help very well. But this man was very neglected and abused by his parents. And he said, even though looking back on this, what Walter Freeman had done to him, he said as a child, "I liked Walter Freeman." Why would you like a man like that? Because he listened to me. He said, even as a child, when I talked to this man, he seemed to care what I had to say. And he liked him for that reason. My children and your children are no different. If I'm always giving them half of my brain while the other half of the brain goes to television or whatever these things are called that we hold in our hand all the time, or my other members of my family, my attention's always just half on them, they know it. And they interpret it to mean just exactly what it means, that I don't care about them to the extent I ought to. So, I first of all take stock of where I stand before God. I secondly seek to win my child's heart by showing them love, by being involved myself in them, caring about them, and letting them know I care about them, in words and actions. And then with that in place, I'm ready to start teaching and training and disciplining them. And this is a whole lesson in and of itself. I'm just going to hit on some highlights. Could someone please tell me who bears the chief responsibility for training children in the ways of the Lord? Who is it? It's the Father. It's been this way from the beginning. All the way back in the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 18, verse 19. Here's what God said about Abraham. He said, I have known him in order that. So I've established this relationship with him in order that he may command his children and his household after him that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice. I have established a relationship with Abraham to the end for the purpose of him teaching his family in the right ways. Joshua said, as for me and my house, what? We will serve the Lord. That was his decision. To as much as he was able, he was going to lead his family in service to God. Fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. That's Ephesians chapter 6, verse 4. And if you look at Ephesians 5 and 6, you see seven groups of people. Wives, husbands, children, fathers, bondservants, masters, and then finally he says, my brethren. So fathers is not shorthand for parents. When he says fathers, he means fathers. Fathers, we are given the responsibility to make sure that our children are brought up in the training and instruction of the Lord. So let me ask you, who is doing the spiritual initiating in your home? What do you mean by that? Well, when it comes to spiritual things, who's using the word let's? Who's saying, let's read the Bible together as a family. Let's pray. Let's go to that meeting. Let's go to be a part of that Bible study. Let's make sure we help the church in this particular activity. Who's saying those things in your home? Whoever's saying those things is probably the one doing the spiritual leading in your home. It needs to be we fathers. And I know that fathers have a tough road today on multiple levels, but the demands that are being made on you, if you are a competent worker in the 21st century, are great. From what I hear from brothers, it almost seems like these companies will sap the very life out of you if you let them. They will use all your time. They'll have you on the road flying you here and here and here and here all the time if you let them. And I ask you to consider something in light of your work. You know, I don't know why God made us this way, and I don't know if He actually made us this way, although I think He did somewhat. But as men, we tend to define ourselves by what we do. We value what our self-worth is tied up in what we do. So it becomes very important to us to succeed, quote-unquote, at the workplace. Consider with me Jephthah. What do we know about Jephthah, the man who would be the judge? We know a lot of things about him. What do we know about his parentage? Does anybody remember? Judges chapter 11 tells us that Jephthah was illegitimate. His father had had him through another woman. So here he is at home. All his brothers have the same mother and father, but he is the outcast. And finally, Judges 11 tells us they kick him out. And so here you have this man who's probably got a bit of an inferiority complex, a bit of a chip on his shoulder. He wants to prove something. And the children of Israel find themselves at the mercy of the nation of Ammon. They're needing a leader to take them out into battle. And there just happens to be Jephthah, who right now is running with a pretty rough crowd. But everybody knows Jephthah is a competent leader. Men follow him. And so they come to Jephthah and they say, hey, would you lead us out to battle against Ammon? As you may remember, Jephthah says, all right, yeah, I'll do it, but if I win, I get this place of prominence among you. And they were so desperate, they said, you got a deal. Now what Jephthah does next is where this becomes relevant. I don't know what Jephthah was thinking when he did this. But Judges chapter 11, starting in verse 30, he prays to God and he says, "If you will indeed deliver the people of Ammon into my hands, then it will be that whatever comes out of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the people of Ammon shall be the Lord's. And I will offer it up as a burnt offering." And if you're like me, what did he think was going to happen? I guess he must have thought some animals could potentially walk out. Well, we don't know exactly how the house was arranged, but it wouldn't be unlike some cultures to have animals in the home, near the home. So he must not have thought that what happened would happen. But it did happen. Jephthah comes home and his daughter comes out. And he is terribly grieved when she comes out. Now, why am I telling this story? Did Jephthah intentionally turn his back on his daughter? Of course not. Did Jephthah want the best for his daughter? I'm sure he did. Did Jephthah love his daughter? Yes. Jephthah did not intentionally do a bad thing to his daughter. But he loved success so much that he made a rash vow that had terrible consequences for her. A man can do this. Yeah, I'll take that temporary job away from home. It's only for a year. Well, she's little now. It doesn't matter if I spend a lot of time at work. I'll be able to do more fun things with her when she's older. I'll work these extra hours just until I climb one more rung of the corporate ladder, and on and on and on. What shall a man profit if he gain the whole world and lose his own daughter and lose his own child? Our children need us at home with them. It may sound old-fashioned, it may sound antiquated, but they need us. Let me touch on a couple more things real quickly and then we'll close. Fathers, train up your children, bring up your children in the training and admonition of the Lord. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, Moses said this, starting in verse 6. "These words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up." The picture Moses paints for us is a parent who makes discussing the Bible part of the rhythm of life. I was struck by this when I was in the Woody household, the Tom Woody household, some 20 years ago. I got to spend about a week at Tom's home. We were out in the garden, we were pulling weeds, and what's Tom doing? We're talking about the parable of the sower. We're talking perhaps about how these weeds are like sin. Now some people would kind of smirk and say, "Oh brother, whatever." But look at the effect. Look at the product. Wisdom is justified by her children. Tom and Luann raised 5 children, and all 5 of them are serving the Lord. It was part of life. It wasn't weird. It wasn't new. It wasn't odd. It was life. What would happen in your home if you were driving down the car on the way to the soccer game and you decided to stick in a Bible CD and listen to it for the 10-minute drive? Would that strike your children as odd? Well, maybe it won't be odd after you do it a little bit. What would happen in your home? And maybe you're already doing this. If in the morning when you had just a little while to eat with them breakfast, maybe you just spent 5 minutes and you said, "Hey, let's make a point. We're going to start every morning with a song. Let's read this together. Or we're going to memorize a verse each week, and come Friday evening before we go out to eat and do all the things we're going to do, we're going to quote the verse together." What if life became like that in your home, if it's not already? What impact would that have on your children? What would that say about what we're here for? This is the picture that Deuteronomy paints for us. One closing thing. I guess we're on point 4. We've talked now about making sure your life is in order so that you can be a spiritual parent. We've talked about winning your child's heart so that the relationship is there, which creates a fertile ground for them to listen and learn. We've talked about the need, although briefly, for teaching, for training, for instruction, and yes, for discipline. Children are like canoes. They go best when paddled from behind. There is need for that. But there's a fourth thing I want to touch on. And I think this one's more important than we give it credit for. Some of us, perhaps, anyway. And that is, just as we wish to win their heart, we must guard their hearts. Proverbs chapter 4, verse 23, Solomon said, "Keep or guard," that's what the word means, "guard your heart with all diligence, for out of it spring the issues of life." I serve or do not serve God from my heart. The heart is where the battle rages. It is where the course for my life, day in and day out, is set. And my heart is like a computer, garbage in, garbage out. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Therefore, a child is not capable of wisely guarding his or her own heart. So God gives that responsibility to me. Why do I make such an issue of this? What's the big deal? Now, I know there are genetic factors, there are biological factors, there are pre-birth factors, and all of those play into what my child is. I have 7 children, and every one of them came out different. Every one of them has genetic propensities. They are there. But to a certain extent, and a large extent, far more than half, 70, 80, 85, percent, to a considerable extent, each of my children, as well as yours, was born a blank book. And the moment they come from the womb, the world starts writing on those pages. And there are lots of ready writers. Everybody wants the opportunity to write in the pages of your child's heart. Other family members, people out in the community, people coming to us from all the different forms of media, they all want to write on the pages of my child's heart. And some of them mean well, and some of them don't. And some of them are too foolish to think about it one way or the other. Not everyone deserves the right to write on the heart of my child. Somebody once said that we should keep out of our child's life anything that will keep Christ out of their hearts. I think that's right. For example, and I'll be vague here, I'm just general, painting a general idea here. Sometimes we as parents, we might think to ourselves, okay, here's this activity, or here's a mode of dress, or whatever it might be. We'll let our children engage in this until a certain point, and when they reach a certain age, we're gonna shut it off. We're not going to allow that anymore. Now, sometimes that might work, but sometimes we're thinking, okay, when they reach a certain age, we're not going to do that because at that point things change, it doesn't become appropriate, or we don't want them involved in that. But what has happened when we allow them to be involved in certain things when they're young? An appetite is developed. And you can take away the activity, but you can't take away the appetite. Because what you allowed them to be exposed to developed the appetite. And now that is there, and they have to contend with it, and you do too. The first time a little boy sees pornography, and I saw my first when I was 6 years old, maybe 7, thanks to a school friend. And then I saw it multiple times thereafter, thanks to kids at school or other people in the world. The first time that little boy sees that picture, his brain fastens onto it and it will never go away. Never. Are you guarding your child's heart? What's on that little electronic thing he or she is carrying around? What are his or her friends showing him? How do you even know? All of that is going in and it is shaping how your child views beauty, how your child views what is important. All of these things are happening. We've got a job to be guards. No, that will not enter my child's heart. Not right now. Right now, I'm going to help. I'm with God's help and with the Bible. I'm going to try to shape my child's worldview so that it matches with God's worldview. And God talks about lots of evil. The worst kinds of evil God talks about in this book. So as we study this book, my child will get exposed to evil. We'll talk about that evil. We'll talk about its reality in the world. And that way, I'm not necessarily isolating, but I'm insulating my child. I'm isolating him from much of the wickedness of the world so that he gets to learn about wickedness through God's glasses. So I'm not keeping him ignorant. I'm not keeping him sheltered, quote unquote, such that he's going to be cast out in the world unprepared. I'm preparing him or her so that he knows how to handle these things. Now, we all have to do our best with God's help to figure out how we're going to do it. But consider what's going into your child's mind and heart. I probably know close to this many people in the church, or who were in the church, who were molested. And they were molested sometimes by family members, people living in the same home, by an uncle, people that the parents trusted, or the people never suspected would be guilty of wrong. We need to take off the blinders, if you will, if you haven't already. I don't mean to make us a bunch of alarmists, but the world is a dangerous place. And people have been hurt very bad by unintended negligence on the part of their parents. Let's watch our children, brethren, and guard their hearts, for out of it flow the issues of their life. What they will largely be determined by what you allow to be in their lives. I want to close with a poem. God, give us Christian homes. Homes where the Bible is loved and taught. Homes where the Master's will is sought. Homes crowned with beauty thy love hath wrought. Homes where the Father is true and strong. Homes that are free from the blight of wrong. Homes that are joyous with love and song. Homes where the mother, in queenly quest, strives to show others thy way is best. Homes where the Lord is an honored guest. Homes where the children are led to know Christ in his beauty who loves them so. Homes where the altar fires burn and glow. God, give us Christian homes. God has a home prepared for you in eternity. If you are one of his children, Jesus said he has gone to prepare a place, and when he comes back, he is going to receive those who are ready unto himself, that where he is, you may be also. If you're not ready for the Lord's return, please take this opportunity you have, because now is the accepted time. Now is the day of salvation. There is no guarantee you're getting out of this door. Now is the time to accept the Lord's invitation. Let's stand and sing.